Online Academy podcast, providing food for body and mind. My name is Carrie Harrison and I have a master's degree in education, a bachelor's degree in science and psychology, and a certificate in plant-based nutrition from eCornell University. This week I'm discussing the philosophical basis of veganism with Brad Wheeler.
One of the things that surprised me when I first became vegan was both how new the vegan movement is and at the same time how old the idea of abstaining from eating animals is. Veganism as a term was coined in 1944 by Donald Watson. So in this sense, veganism is only currently about 75 years old. So when we think about the huge numbers of vegans that there now are in the world, it provides a lot of hope for where we will be in another 75 years. However, the roots of veganism stretch all the way back to the Greek mathematician and philosopher Pythagoras, who was alive in 500 BC, who himself was influenced by his contemporary Buddha. Indeed, veganism was referred to as the Pythagorean diet up until around 1944. So here with me to discuss the philosophical basis for veganism is Brad Wheeler, a long-term vegan and English major who, like me, is obsessed with reading. And Brad and I have had many interesting conversations on this topic. Over to Brad.
Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what are your thoughts about this idea of veganism being both old and new and the roots of the philosophical roots of veganism itself?
Yeah, so this itself is an interesting topic because when you look at the early arguments, for what would be considered veganism or vegetarianism, they're not these complex, sophisticated arguments. They're based on just simple observations. And this is a thing too that I think a lot of people have a misconception about philosophies, that they think it's some guy making sophisticated arguments, sipping his glass of wine in a cosmopolitan atmosphere or something like that. The thing is that early philosophy, and even today, it's based on simple things. And it's interesting to think how one of the things about that is that there's probably many reasons why it's come to this, right? One of it is the influence of the industry that's kind of muddled and confused things. But the other thing, too, is I think people just simply don't think about it. And I don't mean that in a bad way. People got lives and things like that. But anyways, we're kind of getting off topic, so...
I love that idea that philosophy is a lot simpler than you think, because I think people do have this idea in their head that it's very, very complex, deep thought. But yeah, I, like you, when I first started reading around this, I was also struck by the idea of these are the very simple thoughts that I have these days in terms of veganism and vegetarianism.
Back, I can give you some examples. So like an early introductory philosophy, I'm a little bit rusty, but basically, you know, for example, there's three schools of thought. So there's empiricism, skepticism, and dualism. So empiricism is basically based, you know, on what you can detect with your senses. Dualism is that there's a metaphysical aspect to everything. Skepticism is that, well, you can't really trust anything. And so, let's just pick on skepticism for a minute. You say you can't really trust anything. You think you can't have an argument with those people. You can't talk to them. But there are some powerful arguments that are hard even to defend against today. So for an example is that you can say, well, you know, so there's stairs like in the next room. How do you know those stairs are there right now? What is your proof? How do you know they're not disappearing? How do you know you're not just imagining it? It gets increasingly complex when you try to answer those questions. So it's just simple things like that. It's not really that complex.
I love that. You're bringing me right back to my first philosophy classes years and years ago. So we have Pythagoras, who is like the classic initiator of the idea, as far as we can tell, of veganism or pure vegetarian diet. Things kind of rumble along for hundreds of years with a few people popping up in support of animal rights, notably Leonardo da Vinci in the 15th century, the Italian inventor and artist who was renowned by his contemporaries for his great love of animals. There's no proof that he was actually vegan, but he certainly was for animal rights. Then about 100 years later, French author Voltaire too made references to animal rights in his writing during the 17th century. Again, it's pretty clear that he himself wasn't a vegan, but he was starting to make people think about animal rights.
Yeah, actually I have this quote by Voltaire. It's fairly long, but so I'll just read the last half. But at first, in the first half, it's important to know that he's talking about how people dissect these animals alive. That was gruesome. But he asks, after you dissect them, he's like, and what you then discover in him are all the same organs of sensation that you have in yourself. Answer me, machinist. Has nature arranged all the springs of feeling in this animal to the end that he might not feel? Has he nerves that he may be incapable of suffering? So, and again, that's just a simple observation. As I mentioned earlier with philosophy, it's not this complex thing. It's like he's asking, it has all the same sensations and organs that you have. Is it just for nothing so he doesn't feel or suffer as we do?
That really reminds me of, who is the philosopher that I think therefore I am? Who is that again?
That was Descartes.
So Descartes was infamous for his vivisection of dogs alive, and he used to nail them down and cut them open. But he was of the mind that it was that they weren't actually in pain; that it was us imposing our personifications onto them. And that when I read that about him, it really changed my mind about him as a person, because he's often revered. Any thoughts about him?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things to where he had this. I'm Rustin Descartes, but basically he had this idea that I think, therefore I am, so I have consciousness, and that basically these animals didn't have consciousness in the way that that people do. So in a sense, they aren't the same. They don't have a soul or anything like that. Yeah, but then, you know, the question I would put to him, which I haven't, it's been a long time since I've read him, so I don't know if he's answered this. But the same thing, what I would say to any other person, it's like, well, okay, so do they not suffer? How do you know that? Which was the ironic thing for Descartes, because he had this assumption that basically that he says, I think, therefore I am, because he had to assume that at least something was true, that if everything was, that there was some kind of demon that was tricking him. So this was the first, this was like his starting point of philosophy. How he makes that jump is interesting, not in a good way. And again, I would point to what Voltaire said. Yeah, you don't have to bring in the idea of a consciousness even within an animal to say that it suffers.
Makes perfect sense to me. So from Voltaire, we can fast forward another few hundred years again, and here in America we begin to read the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Another huge name that we're all no doubt familiar with through his involvement in the American Romantic movement. What surprised me was that back in the 19th century, here was a man attempting to bring public attention to the fate of animals in slaughterhouses. And a famous quote from him is, "You have just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity." For me, it's surprising because we have moved so far to an industrialized model of agriculture, but here back in the 19th century, when things must have been on a much smaller scale, he is still talking about the horror of the slaughterhouses. Brad, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is, I think, kind of like the background is interesting too to consider, because like today, you know, we do have this large industrial complex of animal agriculture, and a consequence of that, they want to stay in business and make money, so we have a lot of propaganda to deal with. And so Emerson's, you know, ideas, I think, were, interestingly enough, more convincing then, because there wasn't a lot of propaganda to go around. And as a consequence, it was much easier to realize and to see the connections. And just like with ancient philosophy to, you know, to Emerson's ideas, and his observations, it's not complex. It's just a simple thing. This is how it is.
Yeah, as you're speaking, I'm reminded of where I grew up, which was back in rural Scotland. And I think things were a bit simpler back there, even in the 1980s. And I had two slaughterhouses, two small-scale slaughterhouses, in both of the small towns that were beside me. So it was very much more obvious as a young person growing up what was happening to these animals. So it wasn't as hidden. So I think this idea of things being hidden and the propaganda that we're all dealing with is quite interesting. As we get closer to the modern day, we find more and more philosophers and thinkers speaking up about animal rights and abstaining from eating their flesh. I know that I was surprised to learn that Albert Einstein was a vegetarian, and I don't think this is something that is commonly known until you become vegan. And he had this to say about eating animals. Nothing will benefit human health and ensure survival of life on Earth more than the evolution to a vegetarian diet. What are your thoughts on Einstein's thinking there?
Yeah, so the same thing with Einstein as Emerson and everybody before him. It wasn't, you know, and it's interesting because he was a, what was it? He was a physicist or astrophysicist. And this is something I wanted to hit upon. You know, Einstein was a brilliant guy. And the thing is, though, it doesn't mean you have to be intelligent to realize these things. I mean, this was just a classic, simple observation that he made or conclusion he came to. So yeah, I just wanted to point that out. You don't have to be super intelligent. In fact, it wasn't even necessary for, you know, in my opinion today, to me, it's not necessary to be super intelligent to make this observation about animals and veganism.
Absolutely, that's a great point. Another great mind around this time that we hear from is Albert Schweitzer. Albert Schweitzer was the Nobel Prize winner and a mathematician. He was greatly influenced by the Indian religion of Jainism and the practice of ahimsa and non-violence. And he said, "Compassion, in which all ethics must take root, can only attain its full breadth and depth if it embraces all living creatures and does not limit itself to humankind."
Yeah, so this also I find interesting. We actually have a Jain community here in Houston. In fact, where I work, they had a Jain community. So Jainism is, from what I remember, like, I'm not going to get it right because I'm not a Jainist, but you know, it is a religion of nonviolence and I think pacifism as well. And so, but what's interesting is that they're not necessarily making a religious argument in the sense that you have to be of that religion to make it. In fact, the argument that they're making is actually fairly secular, in which they're saying that compassion is to be extended for it to make sense. That's a logical conclusion. You don't have to be of that religion or religious to make that connection. And so I find that interesting that, you know, when people think of compassion, they, and I'm not saying people are bad for doing this, but they generally don't think of it of extending it to other things. You know, we want to extend compassion to women, to minority groups and things like that, but also, you know, the other thing that's involved are the animals as well. And they're connected in other ways too when you think about it, you know. The exploitation of people comes with the exploitation of animals, the chicken farmers and things like that, which I think we talked about how that cycle continues.
Yeah, absolutely. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about, I'm a teacher, so the schools I work in, they often communicate to the children about kindness and compassion. It's quite often part of the school's vision and moral values, but never is it touched upon to be kind to other animals. It's always about kindness and compassion to other human beings, which of course is important, but unless we show compassion to all creatures, then we're going to be living in a violent world. So that has problems.
And actually, I would say that you can't exactly, like, I would take it a step further, that you can't exactly show compassion to people unless you show compassion to animals. And I'm not necessarily, you can only do one or the other, but I'm saying that they're linked. The example that I just gave a few minutes ago is that, well, you know, to stop the exploitation of people, you have to stop the exploitation of animals, like I said. So people don't know briefly, you know, basically the chicken farmers here in America, at least, they're in a situation to where they have to do what these companies say and not complain, or they can lose the way they make money, right? So they can basically overwork them, charge them more, do whatever they want, and our politicians don't care. And so one way to end that would be, of course, to move them over to vegetable agriculture. And so I think that, you know, this is just one of many examples in which we have to extend it to animals as well for the benefit and the welfare of both. The other thing too I wanted to hit about was compassion and empathy. So compassion is being kind or doing what's right by someone. Empathy is having that feeling. So I think the way that Paul Bloom described it, he's a psychologist. This is from the book Just Babies. He talks about the morality in children, but he says that compassion is wanting to save somebody who's drowning, right, when you see them. Empathy is when you see that person drowning, you feel like you're drowning with them, or you can identify with that situation. I think that part of the reason why we extend compassion and empathy to people, but not to animals in general, is understanding the difference between the two. I think that a lot of people, they feel the empathy, right? Go watch these safari videos, and people don't like seeing the lion killing the zebra, right? But then they'll probably have a hamburger for dinner. And I think it's more closely drawing a link between the two, right? Because you can have empathy, but not compassion. Another good example is the story of a Nazi secretary, right? This is during World War II, and Jews are getting gas next door, and she just can't stand it. Like she writes this note saying she has to be, she just can't stand it. She can't take it anymore. Please move her. And that's it. So then they transfer her, and that was it. So she had the empathy, right? It really disturbed her and bothered her, but she's like, oh, just move me next door. And that was that. So I think it's the kind of divide between compassion and empathy that we need to be, is something that we need to draw a clearer link to.
I find that story about the secretary working in Nazi Germany just absolutely fascinating. Because when you first told me that tale, I thought the secretary was going to do something about it. I thought she was going to, speak up about perhaps how horrifying it is, and what else, is there not another way that this could be handled? But the fact that she just wanted it out of her line of sight is very interesting.
And I think this is actually another thing to be considered too, is psychology. So it's actually one of the things that I think as vegan activists, we need to consider. So a lot of people focused on protests and things like that, which is fine, but you have to consider the study of history and psychology. So for an example, so there were two groups of people when Hitler took power. There was the youth, right? And then there were the older generation. So the older generation, for the most part, they weren't indoctrinated. And this is important for the context. But basically, there's a book that details how these soldiers, they did not agree with Hitler. They were not on board with him. But they ended up shooting and killing women, in the field, pregnant women as well. And what had happened was that they were in a situation to which they didn't, this is a long story short, but they had this sense of camaraderie and say, well, I don't want you to do this alone. They could have left at any time. But by degrees, the Nazi soldiers made them go one step further, one step further, one step further. So there's a clear method going through. Because if they had told them, just go shoot these women now, they probably would have said no. They said, nope, just do it in degrees. And again, they weren't on board with Hitler, but they had this sense that, well, I don't want you to do this alone, or I can't leave you. It's just an interesting bit of psychology. So imagine if you go to the slaughter, they say that, well, it's a terrible thing, and I'm sure there are people who don't want to be working there. They say, well, who else is going to do it? Or maybe, or there's other aspects too, well, this is the only job I have. But I think it's different elements of psychology that...
I know, I couldn't agree with you more. I know that slaughterhouse workers, as you're talking, the desensitization that is brought on board by working in slaughterhouses, and even vegan activists that have gone in to get undercover footage, they themselves speak about working in chicken slaughterhouses and just becoming completely desensitized to the process, because it's the way that your brain copes with it. If your brain didn't become desensitized, you would end up having a mental breakdown. So very, very interesting stuff. My own personal favorite story about a famous vegan is from one of my favorite authors, Tolstoy. He was a vegetarian, and when a well-to-do lady was invited to dinner, she insisted that there should be chicken as part of the meal. Tolstoy took this request and dealt with it as any decent gentleman would. And as the guests came in to sit down to dinner, there was an extra chair in place setting at the table. And the guests are sitting there wondering who else is coming to dine with them. And then in comes the butler with a live chicken and sits her down in the seat. And Tolstoy says something along the lines of, I believe someone wanted to have chicken for dinner, so I invited one to join us. Just love that. I just love it. So any closing thoughts, Brad, on this conversation?
The thing I think that should be made clear here is just that, it's not that, we're propping up these people that, oh, they were vegans, so should we. I mean, granted, they were intelligent people, but it's not based on that. It's based on the fact that if these intelligent people can make this simple observation, then so can we. And it's also the fact that their arguments, regardless of their personality, stand true, right? Everybody's flawed. In fact, I want to talk on the provocative issues that, Hitler was a vegetarian. I want nothing to do with that guy, or to be associated with him. And of course, he was vegetarian, looked like, for health reasons. And so that's why I say that it's not so much based on the character, but the arguments And I think we talked about it too. There are also some people we don't want to be associated with, even if they are vegan. Yeah, and so just to hammer that home is that rather than relying on these figures, we should point out how their logic or different points of views all lead them to the similar conclusion. But like with the thing with Pythagoras, I remember reading Ovid's Metamorphoses. It's a book about mythology and transformation, mostly people turning into trees. But towards the end of the book, I don't remember exactly if it's Ovid himself or he's putting Pythagoras there. But either way, I think Ovid was a follower of Pythagoras. And he basically made the argument about animal welfare, at least, is that you have this bull or this cow pull your plow, but yet you want to go slaughter and eat him. It's like, why would you do that to your friend? And that was such a simple argument back then. And it was interesting because I didn't expect to read that there. And Grant, while the book was a work of fiction, he was putting Pythagoras' philosophy in that book.
And it just chimes perfectly with how I wanted to end this conversation. My final quote of the day is engraved on a pendant that I often wear, and it's by Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw. And it reads, "Animals are my friends, and I don't eat my friends." And I think that says it all. Thank you very much, Brad.
Yep. Thank you for having me. Take it easy.
Thank you for listening to this Vegan Online Academy podcast. If you have been inspired to start your own vegan journey or would like more support with the vegan journey that you're currently on, please log on to veganonlineacademy.com for more information about our courses.